we have seen that shift where we'll have more showery and precipitation here for the rest of the summer.
Interior firefighters get some help from the weather, but the fire season is not over yet. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the difficult work of determining the cause of a plane crash.
We look at three main areas when we get on an accident site: manned, machine, environment. So right now, none of those three areas have been discounted at this point.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Wreckage of a plane that went down Friday afternoon 18 miles west of Juneau was being picked up yesterday for further investigation by the National Transportation Safety Board. Wings of Alaska Flight 202 from Juneau to Hoonah crashed into a mountain north of Point Howard on the mainland, killing the pilot. The Cessna 207 was carrying four passengers who survived the crash. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
The purpose of the National Transportation Safety Board is to perform an in-depth investigation to determine probable cause of the crash. Clint Johnson describes it as a process of elimination. Johnson is chief of the Alaska Regional Office in Anchorage.
We look at three main areas when we get on an accident site: manned, machine, environment. Manned being the human performance portion, machine being the mechanical, and the environment is obviously the weather. So right now, none of those three areas have been discounted at this point.
Johnson says NTSB investigator Chris Shaver spent Saturday at the crash site, which is steep and tree-covered. Johnson says the investigative team for the wreckage includes representatives from the airframe manufacturer Cessna Aircraft Company and the engine manufacturer Continental Motors. That process takes a few days. Johnson says Shaver is also working closely with Wings of Alaska.
That is a part of the investigation. Chris will probably be in town for the next 2 or 3 days, if not longer than that, conducting a number of interviews as far as management personnel, other pilots that knew this pilot, dispatch personnel. There's a host of people.
Wings Flight 202 departed Juneau on Friday around 1 p.m. for what was supposed to be an 18-minute flight. The Juneau Police Department received a 911 call from someone on the plane around 1:20 reporting the crash. The pilot was 45-year-old Fariah Peterson of Birmingham, Alabama. Her body was recovered Saturday afternoon and will be sent to the state medical examiner's office for an autopsy. The four surviving passengers are 64-year-old Ernestine Hanlon Abel of Hoonah, 57-year-old Humberto Hernandez Aponte, and wife 60-year-old Sandra Herrera Lopez of Juneau, and 15-year-old Jose Vasquez of Puerto Rico. They were all initially brought to Bartlett Regional Hospital in Juneau. Hanlon Abel and Herrera Lopez were medevaced to Harborview Medical Center in Seattle. As of Sunday afternoon, both were in serious condition in the intensive care unit. The weather near Point Howard Friday afternoon was similar to the weather in Juneau: low clouds, light rain, and patchy fog, according to a meteorologist at the National Weather Service. Wings of Alaska canceled all flights on Saturday, the day after the crash. Service resumed on Sunday. Johnson says a full NTSB investigation takes 9 months to a year. He says a preliminary accident report will come out sometime this week. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska State Troopers say a Trapper Creek man died yesterday after his plane struck a tree while flying over his daughter's wedding reception. 54-year-old Michael Zagula died after the landing gear from his Cessna struck a tree and caused the aircraft to crash. Trooper spokeswoman Beth Ibsen says the crash occurred in Trapper Creek. National Transportation Safety Board Chief Alaska Investigator Clint Johnson says an investigator is scheduled to visit the crash site today. Zagula's body will be sent to the state medical examiner's office for an autopsy. A key ship in Shell Oil's Arctic drilling fleet left Alaska yesterday. The icebreaker is headed south to Oregon for repairs after a 3-foot gash was discovered in its hull. KUCB's John Ryan reports.
The icebreaker called the Fennica hit an uncharted rock as it was leaving Dutch Harbor for the Chukchi Sea. It had to return to port for temporary repairs. That was 2 weeks ago. Now the Fennica is making a week-long journey to a shipyard in Portland, Oregon for a more permanent fix. Shell wouldn't say how long those repairs could take. The company can only drill during the brief Arctic summer, and it cannot drill for oil without an oil well capping device that's on board the Fennica. Two Shell oil rigs are already on their way to the drill site in the Chukchi Sea. U.S. officials have not said whether the missing icebreaker will influence their decision on two final permits that Shell needs to begin drilling. In on Alaska, I'm John Ryan.
Areas of the interior have received rain in recent days, helping to slow wildfires that have charred more than 4.7 million acres. But as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, fire season is far from over.
A swath of the interior, including the Fairbanks and Denali areas, got a thorough soaking over the weekend. National Weather Service meteorologist Benjamin Bartus credits a low-pressure system that parked itself over the region and is expected to yield additional showers before moving out. Longer range, Bartus says it appears that the general weather trend has changed.
Generally, 1 month out of the summer, you know, we'll have more of a wetter weather pattern, and that month is generally August. So I think we have seen that shift where we'll have more showery and precipitation here for the rest of the summer.
The rain subdued some of the numerous wildfires around the interior at the time of summer when fire managers are reassessing their strategy. Division of Forestry spokesman Tim Mowry says mid-July is usually when fire managers set a conversion date.
Fire managers will look at the weather, look at the current situation, and depending on what they see and what they speculate, they'll sometimes take areas that are in modified suppression zones and knock them down to limited suppression zones where we monitor fires more than take direct action.
Not all areas received rain over the weekend, and a few new wildfires were reported, including a lightning-caused blaze on the Seward Peninsula. Mowry says some aircraft and personnel have been released from service in the state, but minimal demand in the lower 48 has allowed Alaska to retain a lot of suppression resources, including over 2,000 firefighters. Given the amount and size of Alaska's wildfires this summer, Mowry says plenty of work remains to be done in the state.
They're still cleaning up and mopping up on the Sockeye fire. You know, minimal personnel, but they're still finding spots of heat and berms along roads that they're pulling apart with an excavator. And same thing down on the Card Street fire down on the Kenai Peninsula. You know, these fires that we put a lot of work into, and they put dozer line in and did a lot of stuff like that. They're still finding heat spots.
Mowry says state and federal agencies have already spent about $100 million fighting fire in Alaska this summer. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Alaska Legislature's Committee with Gatekeeping Authority over expediting the governor's Medicaid plans meets on Wednesday, but does not intend to take up the program's expansion. That's according to the Office of Representative Mike Hawker, chair of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. If the committee does not act on the governor's plans, the expansion of Medicaid is expected to go forward automatically on September 1st. Governor Bill Walker announced last week his intent to expand Medicaid with or without the legislature's blessing. Separately, the committee is taking up contract proposals on Wednesday to hire a Medicaid expert to consult for the legislature through the 2016 legislative season. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a federal education bill that gives tribes more authority.
This will not only honor our constitutional relationship to Alaska Natives, but ensure that they can take on more responsibility for helping their children succeed.
That's ahead. Stay with us. In a ruling issued Friday, Alaska's Supreme Court upheld a lower court ruling that struck down the Save Our Salmon initiative. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
The Save Our Salmon initiative was adopted by a narrow vote in the Lake and Peninsula Borough in 2011. It established a borough-level permitting process to develop a mine like Pebble. Its sponsors believed it would not only add a layer of protection against Pebble, but perhaps preempt the mine developers from investing further in the project, since that permit would be all but impossible to obtain. Save Our Salmon was challenged in court by Pebble and the state of Alaska in separate lawsuits, which were later joined. In March 2014, Superior Court Judge John Suttuck ruled in their favor, striking down the initiative, saying it superseded the state's Natural Resources Permitting Authority under the Constitution. The ballot sponsors George Jacko and Jackie Hobson, who were backed financially by Bob Gillum, appealed the ruling to the Supreme Court. On Friday, the court issued a 20-page opinion siding with Suttuck that Save Our Salmon was not lawful and leaving it overturned. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
An education bill that passed the U.S. Senate last week includes several provisions that boost the role of Alaska Native tribes. The bill, called Every Child Achieves, rewrites the law known as No Child Left Behind, a key piece of the domestic legacy of President George W. Bush. Senator Lisa Murkowski, who sits on the Senate Health and Education Committee, says she added a provision requiring states and school districts to consult with tribes and Native parents as they develop education plans.
I think it's time that our tribes and our Native organizations throughout the country will be part of designing the plans and shaping the programs used to improve schools that serve our Native students.
The bill establishes a competitive grant program to support Native language immersion schools. The legislation doesn't authorize a specific amount of money for the grants. Murkowski also used the bill to revise the Alaska Native Education Equity Program. The long-standing grant program last year gave some $30 million to Alaska school districts, the University of Alaska, tribal groups, and nonprofits. Murkowski says if the bill becomes law, future grants will go directly to tribes and Native organizations that have expertise in running education programs or to tribes that partner with school districts.
This will not only honor our constitutional relationship to Alaska Natives, but ensure that they can take on more responsibility for helping their children succeed.
The bill passed the Senate by a wide margin. U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan praised it for easing the mandates of No Child Left Behind and reducing the amount of testing that eats up classroom time. But Duncan also says the bill doesn't do enough for low-performing schools. A fire destroyed a sailboat, part of a dock, and equipment owned by the Jackalof Bay Oyster Company last night. No one was injured in the blaze. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
The fire started Sunday evening in Little Jackalof Bay, about 7 miles southwest of Homer on the south side of Kachemak Bay. Johann Willrich was out on a porch at about 10 p.m. in Little Tutka, a neighboring bay. He says he saw black smoke that looked larger than a garbage fire, so he and other residents hopped in their boat to find out what was going on.
Drove over toward Little Jackalof Bay, and as soon as we turned the corner, we saw, I had a handheld VHF, and someone was reporting that there was a boat on fire and the dock itself was on fire as well. As soon as we turned the corner, we saw the boat was fully involved, and we got there just in time to see the mast fall over.
Residents of the remote South Bay are often the first responders to incidents, as it can take quite a while for fire departments or other official responders to travel from the larger Seldovia or from Homer. The dock and boat are the property of the Jackalof Bay Oyster Company. Its owners declined to be interviewed, but confirmed the losses. Willrich says they tried to reach the boat that was on fire, but it was hard because of the farming operation.
So there were oyster nets strung out all around the dock, a couple hundred yards in either direction. So it was very hard to get to even approach this burning boat.
They were able to cut loose some equipment and another boat and tow them out of danger. Brian Barrett is the chief of the Seldovia Volunteer Fire Department. They responded just after 10 p.m. and tried to salvage as much as they could.
Myself and one other city firefighter was able to get onto the dock and cut loose a raft with their processing equipment and their oyster picking skiff and get those away from the fire. One of those rafts was on fire and we put that out and then pulled that all off the side.
Barrett confirms there was significant damage to the dock and several floats. The boat did sink and quite a bit of equipment that was stored on the dock was also destroyed.
I don't think we'll ever know definitively the cause, but the fire originated in a shed that had a running generator in it that was on one of the floats across to the dock from the sailboat. fire originated in that building, burned that building, burned the adjacent floats, swept across the floats and caught the rigging and the sails on the sailboat on fire, and then burned the boat.
Stephen Russell is the interagency coordinator for the Department of Environmental Conservation. They responded early Monday morning. He says there was no sheening on the water in the area and no known petroleum product spillage, but they will keep an eye on the situation.
Jackalope Bay area is a very sensitive area, not only environmentally speaking, but commercially speaking as well, with the extensive mariculture operations that are going on in that area. Certainly DEC will do anything we can to assist the responsible party and the Coast Guard in mitigating any potential environmental threat.
The full cost of the losses to the oyster company's operations are not known at this time. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
After a spending freeze by the governor and multiple attempts by the legislative minority to place it back into the state's general fund, the Susitna-Watonna Hydro Project team will now be allowed to spend the more than $6 million it has left from previous years. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
Last week, a memorandum from the state's Office of Management and Budget lifted the spending freeze on the Susitna-Watonna Hydroelectric Project instituted by Governor Bill Walker in December. Walker's order had halted new spending on six projects, including the proposed 735-foot-high dam on the Susitna River. At the time of the administrative order, the Alaska Energy Authority, the state corporation in charge of Susitna-Watonna, said it had around $30 million remaining from previous year's appropriations. Of that, $6.6 million was unencumbered. The rest was already committed to studies for the proposed megaproject. Emily Ford, spokeswoman for AEA, says now that the funds have been freed up, the pre-licensing study process will continue through the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
We are just going to be picking up where we left off as part of this initial study report process. We essentially pressed a big pause button in the middle of that effort by filing for a license abeyance with FERC. So next what we'll do is lift that abeyance and resume with the FERC schedule.
The money that AEA is once again allowed to spend on Susitna-Watonna represents just over 3% of the total allocation to the current project proposal to date. Emily Ford says that means there are not currently plans for the type of large-scale research that took place in the Susitna Valley over the last 2 years.
The focus and the goal is to preserve the investment that the state's already made in the project by either wrapping up studies that are near completion or synthesizing data that was collected in the field and making sure that it's in a usable format.
After that, it will be up to the legislature and the governor to determine whether additional funds go to Susitna-Watonna. AEA estimates the project cost at over $5.6 billion, and Emily Ford says that the agency plans to act based on the funding that the state's fiscal reality allows. On Thursday, the Talkeetna-based Susitna River Coalition, a group opposed to Susitna-Watonna, issued a statement expressing disappointment with Governor Walker's decision. The coalition cites criticism by federal agencies, including the National Marine Fisheries Service, of studies conducted as part of the early phases of the project. Coalition board member Becky Long believes that the decision runs contrary to Governor Walker's stated policy goals and that Susitna-Watonna, if built, would be costly beyond the price tag for construction.
We have to look at future litigation costs, future mitigation costs, and, you know, just in general, the governor's been talking up a lot about fiscal responsibility and fish-first policies, and, you know, we think this goes against those policies.
Becky Long says the Susitna River Coalition is concerned that AEA may not be able to finish the studies already underway without cutting corners, which could lead to litigation. Now that the fiscal picture has, at least temporarily, cleared, AEA plans to establish a new schedule with federal regulators. That schedule will include public meetings on the initial study report completed last year. AEA's Emily Ford says those meetings will likely occur in the late fall of this year. In Talkeetna,
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Bernard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Bernard Builder Supply is here to build with you. The Alaska Department of Education is interested in contracting with three experienced Alaskan educators to help underperforming schools improve instruction and student performance. Apply by July 23rd. Inquire at the Department of Education for information. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education.
Every week in 2014, nearly 6,300 households received free food from food pantries and other programs in Alaska. Most of them had at some point to choose between food or transportation, rent, medical care, or heat. And data from the United Way shows the need is rising statewide. From the Urban Affairs Desk, KSKA's Ann Hillman visited a mobile food pantry in Anchorage.
70-year-old Kay Fong darts around the parking lot near the entrance of the Muldoon Community Assembly Church, pointing at tables loaded with food.
Always this end, the veggie, uh-huh. And the pastry, and bread, and the apples, sometimes like the potatoes.
Fong says he found out about the mobile food pantry a couple of years ago when an elderly neighbor received a box of food. Fong needed help himself, so he visited the pantry, then decided to volunteer, too. He only takes food when he needs it, and even then.
I share with a lot of different people.
The food is stacked by type, then counted. The quantity is divided by the number of people who show up, usually 80 or 100. During this drive, each family will receive 2 cartons of juice, a case of frappuccinos, 2 boxes of frozen pizzas, and a pile of veggies to choose from.
If there's any leftover, then you could come back for a second. Everybody equal. I don't use this, you don't have to take them.
Inside the church, people line up, waiting for numbers. They go through the line on a first-come, first-served basis.
Good morning. Do you have numbers already?
Among them is Pamela Nadi. She says she works 40 hours per week, but once she pays her rent, her car insurance, and her student loans, there's nothing left for food.
Who'd have thought that I was going to go to college and, you know, get a bachelor's degree and then a master's degree and then end up, you know, being a consumer here at a food bank, but it happens. Yeah. And you know, the people here make you feel really welcome.
She's been receiving food for about 5 months since moving back to Anchorage from Bethel. She says at first it wasn't easy to ask for assistance.
You know, sometimes I just have to put my pride aside and say, you know, I'm part of the community too, and regardless of what my educational level is, there's times I need help.
Nadi isn't alone. About 60% of the people receiving food help in Alaska in 2014 had been working in the past 12 months. Most of the others were retired or disabled. Sue Brogan with United Way says the 211 resource referral line has seen a nearly 50% increase in the number of referrals for food help statewide from 2012 to 2014. Brogan says it's another coping tool. Help isn't available to pay for utilities or rent directly, so people have to juggle their budgets.
Individuals are using food pantries as a mechanism to, you know, supplant or help pay their monthly bills. So in order to stay housed and pay your utilities, you can go and visit a food pantry.
Sandra Mitchell is the mobile food pantry coordinator for the Food Bank of Alaska. She says the mobile pantries serve a practical purpose. They help get donated perishable foods into the hands of people who need it before it goes bad. The Food Bank of Alaska has distributed more than 7 million pounds of perishables since the mobile program started in 2006. It's about 3,000 to 5,000 pounds per pantry, depending on what's been donated. But as Mitchell looks around at the community members and volunteers chatting and joking, she says it's about more than just food.
It helps people to, not just with nutritional health, but wellness and stability, and knowing that there is some place that they can come and not just receive food, but receive something else also.
There are at least 4 food pantries per week in Anchorage. The food bank also provides supplies for rural areas. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
A Ketchikan minister is going barefoot for a month in hopes of raising awareness of the need for shoes among the world's poor. While only partway through his month-long project, Peter Epler has gotten a feel for what many people deal with all the time. KRBD's Layla Carey met up with him in Ketchikan's busy downtown to see how local residents and visiting tourists react to his bare feet.
I noticed you were looking at my feet. Can I tell you a little bit about it?
Peter Epler's bare feet are a little weird in downtown Ketchikan. Most people here and in developed countries around the world don't think twice about wearing shoes beyond which pair matches which outfit. Some places, though, there's a shortage of affordable shoes, which can be a health and safety hazard.
They walk through dirt roads, their sewer systems, manure, sharp rocks, and kids get cuts on their feet and infection because of what they walk through, and so they can lose their feet or they can die from the infection, and so actually shoes tend to save lives in third world countries.
Epler is a pastor at Ketchikan's Church of the Nazarene. That church and other Nazarene churches in Alaska are working together to raise money for an international charity that provides special shoes for kids in developing countries. The group is called Because International, and the shoes they provide are made to last 5 years.
Yeah, they grow five sizes in 5 years, so roughly kindergarten through fifth grade, and they're working on a second pair that will take them up to ninth grade. So,
how durable are these shoes? I mean, will they actually last 5 years?
Yeah, they'll last 5 years. The rubber on the bottom is made from the rubber that you make street tires from, so for cars. And then they used high-quality leather and industrial snaps.
Many churches involved in the campaign are raising money through their congregations. Epler, though, is taking it a little further in hopes of involving more community members. So to raise awareness, he's pledged to go without shoes for a month. About a week into it, Epler has had some new-to-him tactile experiences.
I've got a blog that I'm kind of keeping track of my own experiences, things that I've stepped in that you take for granted with shoes that you don't...
What have you stepped in?
What haven't I stepped in? I've stepped in unidentifiable wet substances on a hot sunny day. I've stepped in dog poop. I've stepped in gum. That was not my favorite.
The point of going barefoot is to attract attention and hopefully engage people in conversation. Then Epler can talk about the campaign and hand out cards with information about how to donate. Sometimes it works. Sometimes not so much.
Yeah, most people kind of give me the once-over stare like, who's the crazy guy without the shoes?
That was the case as Epler and I walked through downtown Ketchikan.
Yeah, I see what you mean. You just kind of get furtive glances.
Yeah, the glances go from head to toe, and they kind of linger, and then they look away. I tend to wait until someone leans a little in for the conversation before I'm like, here's the card and information, because yeah. I don't want to creep people out. It's enough that I'm the barefoot guy around town. And
Epler says the campaign is raising money, although it's difficult to say how much in total. People in his church have given about $600 so far, but the cards he's handing out direct people to not only the church's webpage, but also to Because International's main site. He says that's a way to reach more people. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lisa Fu and Jeremy Shea in Juneau, John Ryan in On Alaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Dave Menninger in Dillingham, Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.